today on Against the Grain, when Jay Perini sat down to select 13 books that changed America, he decided on three works of fiction: Uncle Tom's Cabin, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and On the Road. I'm C.S. We'll re-present a conversation with the Middlebury College professor about those iconic novels and their impact on U.S. history, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. On the Road by Jack Kerouac. How impactful, how influential, how important were these novels to the development of this country, to the way people in the U.S. came to think and act? Jay Perini's answer is tremendously impactful. He describes and analyzes each of these books in his book, Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. Uncle Tom's Cabin, Perini writes, almost single-handedly created a mass audience for the anti-slavery movement. Huckleberry Finn interrogated race in fundamental ways and introduced a distinctive vision of freedom. And On the Road defined the Beat Generation and prodded readers to think beyond, way beyond, the puritanical confines of U.S. middle-class life. Jay Perini is a poet, novelist, biographer, and professor of English and creative writing at Middlebury College. When Jay joined me via Skype, I began by asking how he went about choosing the 13 books to include in his book, Promised Land.
Well, it kind of drove me crazy trying to think of 13 books that changed America. I had this arbitrary idea of 13. I was in England back in about 2006, and there was a big popular book called 12 Books That Changed the World. And I noticed that they were all English books. and that kind of made me angry. So I thought, well, let's try and do 12 American books that changed America, at least. I finally wound up with 13. And I, in my head, jokingly justified it by saying, oh, well, there were 13 original colonies. So I had to think, okay, what would be the key books? And I didn't want to say the 13 greatest books. I was looking for 13 books that really shifted how Americans saw themselves, how the American character was formed by these books. And so I was looking for books like The Federalist Papers or the book of Plymouth Plantation, The Pilgrim's Landing in Plymouth Rock, Governor Bradford's Diaries. Or I was looking at crazy books like How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. In fact, one of the more bizarre books I picked was Baby and Child Care by Dr. Spock, because I think that's a book that really revolutionized child care in America. And so I did very, very few novels, and they had to be novels in my little thesis here that actually shifted people in some perceptible way and help to define what it is to be an American. And so for me, the three novels we're going to talk about today were books that really did do this. We're talking about On the Road by Jack Kerouac, which really opened up the whole beatnik hippie thing, post-modern consciousness in a weird way. Or something like Huckleberry Finn, which is our key defining novel, or a book that isn't really even a good book, Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. I think it was George Orwell who referred to it as a good, bad novel. And so I was interested in books that shifted America's ideas about itself.
Yeah, let's start with Uncle Tom's Cabin. I want to spend time with you on each of these three novels. What was Abraham Lincoln purported to have said to Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, upon meeting her at the White House?
Well, he said to her, now here you are, the little lady that started this great war. And in some ways, she was really responsible in a very small way, but a perceptible way, for the Civil War in America, because she so inflamed the abolitionist movement, and she so inflamed the South, and she really created a divide that you know, it's hard to imagine how divided America was in the 1850s. This book came out in 1852, when the divisions over slavery were just ramping up. If we think it's bad now in America with Trump's America versus liberal America, you just imagine yourself back into the 1850s. And we're talking about a war that slaughters millions of Americans.
How popular was Uncle Tom's Cabin? How well did the book sell?
Well, actually, it was the best-selling novel in America in the 19th century. Only the Bible sold more copies, I believe. And so it was. At many times, they had to keep as many as a dozen printing presses running 24/7 just to keep copies of the book hurtling off the press because there was such demand. You know, it was astonishing. I mean, it even sold a million copies in Britain. The book was sold all over the world in many, many translations. And so it was just a massive, massive bestseller of a kind that we don't even have examples of that today.
You write about Harriet Beecher Stowe moving from Connecticut to Ohio as a child when her father became president of Lane Theological Seminary in Cincinnati. This was in 1832. What prompted Stowe to write this novel, her first novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin? What about her life to that point informed her views on slavery and her decision to write a novel about it?
Well, you know, she was in Southern Ohio, and Southern Ohio was the first staging ground in the escape on the flight to Canada. So many slaves were escaping from their masters, escaping from plantations, and crossing the Ohio border. And so many people who were abolitionists, like Harriet Beecher Stowe and her family, were hiding such people, hiding slaves, and helping them on their way to Canada. And so this was a kind of a route on the Underground Railroad. And so Beecher Stowe was talking, living, socializing among people who were pretty fierce abolitionists. They were the equivalent of today, liberal Christians. And there was a strong abolitionist movement in the Christian world that Harriet Beecher Stowe grew up in. And her husband, in fact, was a very passionate man. He was a theologian himself, and he worked at the seminary. And so the daily talk in the household was about this kind of thing. And she actually met someone who was very similar to the Eliza, who is the heroine of the novel, who makes the flight to Canada.
Right. The book begins with a slave trader buying from an apparently benevolent slaveholder two people, the middle-aged and beloved Uncle Tom, as well as a young boy named Harry, and that is the son of Eliza, who was a servant to this family. So what does Eliza do when she realizes what this, well, first of all, what the slaveholder has done with her son?
Well, I mean, she's horrified because this is actually a true story. Harriet Beecher Stowe actually went down into Kentucky. She interviewed people. She got slave narratives from actual slaves and benevolent slave owners or people who were covert abolitionists. She interviewed people in Ohio who had encounters with people with slaves and slave owners. So she understood what it was like at a slave auction and how, just like Eliza is panicked that she's going to be separated from her son, you get a lot of mothers and children being separated. I mean, the echoes with today at the border and Mexico-American border is really quite profound. But this was a very commonplace thing that was happening. And these slave auctions, as described in this novel, are pretty horrific. And the way Tom, Uncle Tom, is sold down the river, as they say, is pretty accurate and pretty wrenching. So you could never settle into a particular family, plantation, landscape. You never knew if you were going to be uprooted from your absolutely closest of kin, next of kin, could be just ripped away from you. You were not a human being. You were a piece of property that could be bought and could be sold.
Right, and so then she decides to flee the plantation. I guess her husband, George Harris, who did not live on that plantation, he had also fled separately, right?
He went to Canada, and he said, he left messages saying, I'm going to figure out a way to get you guys free, to liberate you, to maybe buy your freedom, or whatever. There were various ways of maybe freeing a slave, but it was rather fanciful on his part. So it was Eliza's bold move to say, I'm out of here, and to take off on the flight to Canada.
Uncle Tom, so I think maybe listeners need to put aside some of their understandings of Uncle Tom, because he became a character portrayed in many ways after the novel, and it was a much different character than Uncle Tom appears in Uncle Tom's Cabin. Tell us about how Uncle Tom is depicted. What kind of a person is he in the novel?
Well, Uncle Tom is the archetype of the good, long-suffering Christian slave. I mean, it's an archetype that we no longer even can imagine. And nowadays, of course, Uncle Tom is a terrible phrase. If you call somebody an Uncle Tom who's a man of color, a woman of color, you are really accusing them of absolutely caving in to the white population, the majority population. Uncle Tom, nevertheless, was a fairly noble character. I mean, he, right to the very end of the novel, when he's beaten to death by the gangsters who work for Simon Legree, is a kind of, I don't know how to say it, he's a kind of a perfect human being in the sense that he's long-suffering. But what's annoying about him to post-19th century readers is that he was so willing to cave in to the demands of slavery. And given the traditions of slavery, the institution of slavery, there probably were lots of people like Tom who were sort of not resisting, who were saying, let's just be Christians and try to get along here and hope for the best. Hoping for the best, of course, didn't work.
Jay Perini joins me on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He's a poet, novelist, and biographer who teaches at Middlebury College. We're talking about his book, Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. You write that Uncle Tom is a caricature cannot be denied. His portrait remains one-sided. And then about Simon Legree, who was the infamous, cruel, sadistic character in this novel, who buys Uncle Tom, that, you know, he's been criticized, or the character has been criticized as too one-dimensional. Are such criticisms of Stowe's writing, at least in relation to these two characters, valid?
You know, I think one can read this book in two ways. I decided to read the book simply blanking out all my contemporary prejudices about this. Obviously, the phrase Uncle Tom is an epithet that's directed now toward African Americans who are accused of selling out to whites. And we have to blank that out of our mind. We have to read it as it was intended to be read by the author, Harriet Beecher Stowe. And remember, this is a book that in its day was even widely praised by writers like Henry James. Henry James thought it was a marvelous book. He said, we lived in those pages in this story. And Uncle Tom was meant by Harriet Beecher Stowe to be the figure of the noble hero. He was a praiseworthy man. Throughout the book, far from allowing himself to be exploited by the people who own him, Tom stands up again and again for his beliefs. And in the end, he's killed for his beliefs. And finally, he's even grudgingly admired by his enemies. He has an effect on these people. So I always tell people, you know, if you simply blank out your prejudices and read Uncle Tom's Cabin as a novel, you'll be stunned what you get. It's really Stephen King on steroids. She really is a brilliant writer, and she has narrative momentum. It's not surprising that the book sold millions, millions, and millions of copies. It was hugely readable. And to this day, I would defy anyone to begin this book and not put it down.
How central are women characters and women's issues in this novel?
Well, I think you have to look at some of the women in the book. You have Marie St. Clair, the wife of Augustine, who's a kind of a self-absorbed, high-born woman, without a hint of compassion for the people around her. So you get all different kinds of women here. You get Emily Shelby, Arthur's wife. She's a kind of a deeply religious woman who wants to be kind and a moral influence. You get Chloe, Tom's wife, who is almost idealized to the point of not being real. there are many women in the book, and Eliza being in many ways the central one, I think she's somewhat rounded as a character. I mean, flat and round, that's the kind of famous distinction people make between characters. Dickens, for example, had mostly fairly flat characters. Modern novels, we expect a kind of whole characters with many sides. Harry Beecher Stowe's writing in a 19th century tradition, and it's a certain kind of narrative. It's in the tradition of what's called sentimental fiction, and one didn't expect complicated characters. The women are not complicated. They all stand, represent a certain type, I would say.
Jay, how do you think Harriet Beecher Stowe in Uncle Tom's Cabin balanced, you know, the desire to have a good narrative, a strong narrative, a compelling narrative, and her desire, obviously, to inform readers about the horrors of slavery and the importance of ending it?
Well, you know, I think it's just always important to keep in mind that this novel is dominated by the single theme, the evil, the horror, the absolute inhumanity and immorality of slavery. I mean, this is present front and center in the novel. And sure, Harriet Beecher Stowe does weave in some other themes, such as the redeeming possibility of motherhood. And she emphasizes the connections between Christianity and good and bad behavior and evil and good in the Christian viewpoint. And every once in a while, she kind of stops her story and gives a little homily about the destructive nature of slavery. But for the most part, she just hammers home the one theme, everything, all the various rivulets and streams, story streams of the novel, course together into this one great polemic. And Harriet Beecher Stowe was wanting to make a novel that was going to somehow create a difference on the issue of slavery. She wanted to get behind the abolitionist cause. She wanted to condemn slavery. And she wanted to create change in the country. And that's why Abe Lincoln said to her, "Here you are, the little lady that created this great war." He wasn't far off.
Let's turn now to another book of monumental proportions in so many senses, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, published in 1885. What did Hemingway say about the place of Huckleberry Finn in American literature?
Hemingway regarded, he said all American literature comes out of one book by Mark Twain called Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. That's what he said. It stays in my brain somehow. All books come out, all narratives, right? All modern American literature comes out of Huckleberry Finn. And that's a huge claim for a book, but I think it's justified. This is our lodestone, Huckleberry Finn. It's a book I go back to and reread every few years and have done since I was about 20 years old, if maybe even earlier.
Right. You say that, you write that it appeals to and it can inform people at all stages of life. Like you can pick it up when you're young and you get something out of it, but then when you pick it up, you know, as you get older, more lessons or insights can flow because you're more open to them.
Yeah. I mean, when I was about 12, I read the story about Tom Sawyer where Huck appears briefly. And I was enchanted by that idyllic world of Tom Sawyer. And I was quite unprepared for Huckleberry Finn. I think I first read it when I was maybe 14 or 15 or 16 years old, somewhere there in my middle teens. And I was kind of both blown away and terrified by this book. I mean, also unable to even comprehend a lot of it. And I wasn't sure what was going on sometimes. It's certainly not a boy's adventure story of a kind that I was familiar with. As a kid, I read all those boy's adventure stories. And this was something very, very different. I mean, this becomes Shakespearean in its scope, the way it plumbs the human condition at every level. And it's obviously a classic American novel in that it's about lighting out for the territory. It's about going on the road. It's about taking off to escape something and to get somewhere else, looking for paradise.
Well, what is Huck Finn, who does light out for the, quote, territory and gets on a raft with this enslaved person, Jim? What is he trying to get away from?
He's trying to get away from what he calls civilization. And civilization is represented by the old ladies in his life, his aunt, people who want to control him. He's something of an orphan. He's not actually an orphan, but something of an orphan. And in many ways, he's the, as I said, the classic American hero who feels somehow that American society is too polite, that it's actually full of hypocrites. And he wants to live without a tie and jacket. He wants to live out in the country, in the wilderness. He wants to get lost on the river. He wants to live by himself in some strange way. He wants to be self-declaring. I mean, Whitman is, I think, a guiding voice for Mark Twain here. I often like to read Huckleberry Finn alongside of Song of Myself or the Poems of Leaves of Grass, because the Song of the Open Road seems to be very much akin to Huckleberry Finn.
And what about the language that Mark Twain uses in this novel? Did he bring a new sort of language or dialect to literature, to American literature?
What Mark Twain discovered was, for literature, the American voice. I mean, novelists writing in early 19th century America were sometimes prone, certainly the poets were, to try and write like English poets and English novelists. And so Mark Twain blows the lid off that and he says, no, I'm going to write in the dialect of an uncivilized and uneducated boy of 14 years old. And it's just memorable, it's funny, it's inventive in the way that often ordinary speech in America is wildly inventive and funny, even if it's uneducated.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jay Perini joins me. He is D.E. Axon Professor of English and Creative Writing at Middlebury College. He's written 8 novels, including The Last Station, which was made into an Oscar-nominated film, and The Damascus Road, as well as 6 books of poetry and a number of biographies, including of Gore Vidal and Robert Frost. He's got a forthcoming book called Borges and Me. It's a memoir of his travels in the highlands of Scotland in 1971 with the Argentine writer and poet Jorge Luis Borges when Jay was 22 and Borges was in his 70s and blind. It's due out in August 2020. Now, this book, Huckleberry Finn, was, of course, an attack on slavery. It shows us, as you point out, the nobility of Jim. How does Twain's attack on slavery differ from Harriet Beecher Stowe's in Uncle Tom's Cabin?
Well, you know, the novel is set much earlier. It's written in 1885, but it's set 15, 20 years earlier, a period when Missouri was a slave-owning state. And so Jim, who's the other main character in the book, the black man who accompanies Huck down the Mississippi River. Remember, he was property, hardly a human being at all, at least insofar as the law was concerned. And so it was a serious breach of the law in those days to assist a runaway slave. So Twain knew what he was writing about here. He was raised in the South, and he experienced slavery firsthand. His uncle, John Quarles, actually owned a huge farm where he deployed any number of slaves. And so Twain wrote about this, and he understood this.
Did Mark Twain see himself in Huck?
Absolutely. I think that Twain was writing about himself when he writes about Huck Finn. Huck Finn is Mark Twain. And here, Huck Finn is the boy from the South. Huck Finn is the boy who runs away to the river. And Mark Twain was an uneducated genius. Remember, he never went to college, never went to high school. Mark Twain is an autodidact, self-educated. Mark Twain went off and became a riverboat pilot on the Mississippi. One of his greatest books was his memoir of his life on the Mississippi, another great book of his. And so the Mississippi somehow had an archetypal place in the mind of this great writer. And so he puts it as the backbone, the spine of Huckleberry Finn.
So Huck and Jim, they manage to get on this raft, and they go on this amazing journey, and it's not just a physical journey, is it, or a geographical journey. How would you characterize the development or evolution of Huck's moral sense, his maturity over the course of the novel.
Chapter by chapter, Huck and Jim confront all sorts of different kinds of people. They meet fraudsters, they meet essentially circus people, they meet townsfolk who have all the usual prejudices, they meet gangsters and criminals. And so again and again, Huck is forced to look at the people he sees and say, who are these people really? What are they to me? And what are they to Jim? So we see that just the gradual sharpening of the moral conscience of Huckleberry Finn as the novel proceeds. As he goes downriver, he grows dramatically. And so by the end of the river, when he meets up with his old friend Tom Sawyer again, Tom Sawyer is still trapped in boyhood, and the contrast in those last 10 chapters is pretty extreme. Many people have felt that Mark Twain should just have thrown away those last 10 chapters, and I think they're very essential because they show us the distance that Huck Finn has traveled in his moral thinking. And he's not going to sell Jim down the river, and he understands the complications of human life. He understands greed. He understands, actually, all the seven deadly sins are sort of paraded before his eyes, and he comes as a teenager on the brink of adulthood. He comes to terms with all of these things.
And do you see the relationship that is depicted and that develops over the course of the novel between Huckleberry Finn and Jim? Do you see that as Twain trying to suggest a way, an avenue for race relations, a model of racial togetherness that maybe we ought to take seriously?
Oh, absolutely. Can you imagine in 1885 in Reconstruction America coming out with a major novel which suggests that an adolescent boy and an older black man can become close friends, can drift to freedom, can actually help each other? I mean, this is a buddy novel in a sense. But what a thing, a black man and a white boy drifting down on a raft down the river together, having adventures on the road, and coming to some sort of conclusions about each other. I mean, Huck Finn is the least racist character in American fiction. He really does, accept Jim as a kind of father. And so it's Jim who fathers Huck, I think. And I do think that this is, in many ways, still a model story that could be taught and thought about, and it can actually have a corrective influence on a lot of American thinking, even to this day. I mean, this is a very racist country. You know, we need anything we can get in the way of good books that we can actually use in schools to teach children about the nature of race relations.
Twain is so clever with his irony. And, a lot of that, as you were saying earlier, can be lost on a young person, a student, somebody who's picking up this book in, say, middle school or high school or maybe even college. Does that disturb you, or does that kind of make you feel like, because a lot of people won't pick up this book again later in life, as you have, as I luckily have. So they might have missed a lot of what Twain was doing kind of subtly and kind of under the surface.
Yeah, I think it's a shame if the book is lost. It's now rarely read even in high schools. I think I'd be amazed to find a high school kid who's really read Huckleberry Finn. A number have, but only at the better schools with the better teachers. It's probably something that should be read in young adulthood and then reread at least once a decade. It is the American book. I mean, a classic is a book that can't be read. It can only be reread. And I think of this 14-year-old loner, Huck Finn. In his character, America acquired a central type, the outsider with a big heart, the kid who appreciates people from very different backgrounds, but himself refuses to assimilate. And in the end of the day, he must light out for the territory. This is all about the American male desire to take a flight from responsibility, and I've felt that my entire life. I think we all have. There's hardly an American who hasn't some level wish to light out for the territory and had to confront that desire.
You write that without Mark Twain, one could never have had Hemingway or Faulkner. Really?
Yeah, I think that's true. And they both did acknowledge Mark Twain as an essential source. I mean, I've written a biography of William Faulkner, and I did a lot in that book to talk about how Faulkner, and especially in his stories and all the stories of Yaknapatawpha County, really, his characters are endlessly lighting out for the territory, even if it's just on the fringes of Yaknapatawpha County. I mean, the kind of caricatures and hilarious comic types he comes with, the Snopes family, for example, that's all feels very much out of Mark Twain. Also, think of the big river, the Mississippi, and the role it plays in the great novella by William Faulkner, If I Forget Thee, Jerusalem, which is one of his 1939 books, one of Faulkner's perhaps undiscovered masterpieces. It's not read so much. So it also goes under the title The Wild Palms. Hemingway, of course, is writing about lighting out for the territory again and again. I mean, so many of the heroes in the Hemingway books are in search of freedom. And what is Huckleberry Finn if it's not a book, a novel about American freedom, or at least about the idea of freedom? And this has been a governing idea of our nation since the time of the American Revolution, even before.
Jay Perini is his name. We were talking about his book, Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. The 13 books are of Plymouth Plantation, The Federalist Papers, The Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, The Journals of Lewis and Clark, Walden, Uncle Tom's Cabin, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, The Souls of Black Folk, The Promised Land, How to Win Friends and Influence People, The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, On the Road, and The Feminine Mystique. We'll take a short break and speak more with Jay Perini, focusing on Jack Kerouac's classic, On the Road. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Jay Perini joins me. He is a biographer, a novelist, a poet, and a professor of English and creative writing at Middlebury College. He's written, as I mentioned before, 8 novels and 6 books of poetry and a number of biographies. We're talking about his book, Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. Right, so there are 3 novels addressed in this book, and we've talked about 2 of them, Uncle Tom's Cabin and Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. On the Road is the 3rd. It was published in 1957. I'll start with a big question here, Jay. Where does On the Road stand in the American tradition of the road novel?
Recently I've been talking here about Huck and Jim and these buddies traveling down a raft in the Mississippi. And it's easy to imagine that this is a buddy novel. I mean, it is exactly that. You've got Sal and Dean who are taking up these journeys across America and down to Mexico. And it's in many ways inspired by, I think, to some degree inspired by Huckleberry Finn. So I see it as a classic postmodern, well, I don't call it postmodern, but classic, very modern novel. It's one of the key novels to come out after the war. And I think it's an essential book for readers.
Tell us about Sal Paradise and whether he is a stand-in for Jack Kerouac.
Well, this book existed, you know, in various shapes and forms. I think Kerouac began writing it as early as 1948-49, when some of these earliest trips that he writes about actually occurred. He was often traveling with his friend Neil Cassady, and was often having encounters with some of the Beat Generation writers, such as William S. Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg, and Neil Cassady himself was a Beat writer. They all appear in the book, in fact. William S. Burroughs becomes the character of Old Bull Lee, And Allen Ginsberg becomes Carlo Marx, rather funny. And Neil Cassady becomes Dean Moriarty. And there were versions of this book which were actually much more autobiographical and explicit. In the earliest versions of the novel, for example, Neil Cassady is called Neil Cassady. Dean Moriarty comes along a little bit later. And so draft after draft after draft of this book occurred. I mean, there was the famous scroll version of this novel, which was written on these taped together bits of paper, which went on and on and on, the miles of scroll on a typewriter. This is all that sort of very romantic idea that the best thought is the first thought. And so once you just create spontaneously. And so Kerouac just typed and typed and typed one version of this novel from the beginning to the end, almost no punctuation or periods. The final version, the edited version, which his editor at Viking did finally hammer into shape, Malcolm Cowley was the editor, finally has a much more shaped quality to it.
Sal Paradise meets Dean Moriarty early in this book, and they go off on these extended road trips. I think there are five or four major road trips. The first begins in July 1947. Dean Moriarty, as you said, is based on the real life Neil Cassady. Dean is an amazing, incredibly memorable figure. What should we know about him and his energy and his vision, what he's pursuing or going after?
Well, I always think of Dean as a kind of figure, Freud's idea of uncontrolled libido, polymorphous perversity. That was Freud's phrase, polymorphous perversity. And he represents this wild, anarchic, imaginative energy. His sexual energy, for example, is coming out every way you can imagine, mostly in a heterosexual way, but also a homosexual way. I mean, in the earlier versions of On the Road, when we go back to the very first drafts, we see lots of gay sex. That's somehow edited out by the editors at Viking. The book becomes a little more rigid in its final form, but still, you can't suppress Dean Moriarty. You can't suppress Neil Cassady. Apparently, in real life, I've read a lot of the letters of Neil Cassady. He was this exuberant fellow, buoyant, who had a kind of irrepressible quality about him, a boyish quality. And that certainly makes him one of the more memorable figures, characters in American fiction.
Is Sal, I mean, he's clearly enamored with Dean, and he is inspired by Dean. Does he buy into the values, or maybe the lack of ethical values that Dean portrays or depicts or represents?
Well, you know, I think you have to keep remembering that Jack Kerouac was raised in a pretty conservative Roman Catholic working class family in Massachusetts. And I don't think that the Catholic boy ever really left Jack Kerouac. And I always feel, even in his moments of wild flight to freedom, that he's feeling repressed. And he's somehow hampered by his own hesitancy to engage in the full life. And I think he was fascinated by his buddy, Neil Cassady, and whom he wrote about again and again and again. I mean, Cassady comes out in the character, a guy called Cody, in a lot of his later writing. And so the kind of spontaneous energy of Neil Cassady is something that Sal just can't take his eyes off.
Sal and Dean, in their peregrinations, they go and see a lot of jazz. They go to jazz clubs. The writing is incredible in many respects, but I think in particular around laying out the scene at the clubs and the musicians and people listening to jazz in the streets or in the bars. To what extent did Kerouac try and bring his writing, his prose, and jazz together?
Well, I think On the Road is an example of jazz-influenced writing. I mean, it's full of riffs. It's full of melodies that are picked up and caught and carried for a number of pages and then dropped and then picked up later in the book and carried and caught. I mean, it's very much composed along the metaphor of a jazz riff. And so jazz is essential to the book. And also think about what about the world you're talking about, this immediate post-World War II world. This was a very precious little moment in American history, 1947, 1948, 49, 50, 51, before the 50s and the Cold War got their iron clamp on the American consciousness and repression set in a big way. There was this jazz world, this subterranean demimonde where people could go dance, where sex was available, where there was free sex. Actually, my friend Gore Vidal, whose biography I wrote, writes about this in one of his early novels, The City and the Pillar. He talks about the immediate post-World War where there was this homosexual demimonde. And Kerouac really gets into that here. It's not so homosexual, but it's polymorphous perversity exploring itself. And also the use of drugs is important here. You know, Old Bull, William S. Burroughs, and all of the scenes in Mexico. You've got, you know, use of alcohol and various drugs to open up the consciousness. So you can see how On the Road really does give way to the counterculture generation, really. It flows into the Beat society, the Beat writers in the late 50s, early 60s, and then finally in the late 60s opens up into the countercultural moment, which is more than a moment, which lasts on some level into the new age, into this very moment.
To what extent did On the Road define the Beats? I mean, did it push the Beat movement, the Beat generation in a different direction, or was it merely kind of chronicling its development?
You know, I knew Allen Ginsberg, and I remember talking once before he died with Ginsberg about Kerouac. And I asked him to what extent this book had influenced him, meant something in his life. And he said, you know, it was like looking into a mirror and suddenly seeing what we were doing. And then we were just able to do it more intensely. We sort of understood, yes, that's it. That's what we were trying to get at. I mean, Ginsberg was writing Howl. In his later poems, Ginsberg, I think we can hear the echoes again and again of Kerouac's prose in Ginsberg's poetry. And, you know, it's pretty funny the way Ginsberg is portrayed as Karl Marx in the book. I mean, Ginsberg thought that was pretty funny. He said that wasn't him at all, but it was a version of him. You could see it.
I'm speaking with Jay Perini. On the Road by Jack Kerouac is one of the 13 books that Jay discusses in detail in his book Promised Land, 13 books that changed America. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain. So as you said, the character of Old Bull Lee in Jack Kerouac's On the Road is based on William S. Burroughs, the author of, among many other books, Naked Lunch. You argue that Kerouac used Old Bull Lee to voice Kerouac's, the author's, skepticism about American waste and extravagance. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think Kerouac himself was a little hesitant to be declarative about the ghastliness of American life. It was something depressing in his own childhood, the repressed Catholic background that he was always running away from and then being sucked back into. It was a terrible pattern in his life where he would flee, run away from home, and then go back, flee it again and go back. He was always trying to somehow come to terms with whatever it was he was trying to flee, which was often his Catholicism. And the straightness of the life that he had seen, just, you know, when he went to Columbia, people were living a very straight life, and he wanted liberation. And William S. Burroughs was nothing if not liberated. The guy was a druggie. The guy had a wild imagination. And he was kind of a living embodiment of a version of Walt Whitman. And so Kerouac looked at him and said, yes, there we go. That's the character of the rebel, the outlaw, who is so crucial to whatever is interesting in American literature.
In one of the latter parts of the book, Sal gets really sick in Mexico. So he and Dean have driven down to Mexico. He gets really sick, and Dean basically abandons him in Mexico all alone, and Dean returns to the States. How does this affect how Sal sees Dean?
Well, I think it again wakes him up to, it's a bit like Huck Finn encountering realities which sort of shade his understanding of human nature. He understands that it's complicated, that people are often very selfish, driven by ego, and they need to somehow rise above this if they're going to find it, as he calls it in the novel. I mean, a lot of this novel is about the search for something called it, I-T, and that might be the search for goodness in man, might be the search for God. Kerouac would say to people in later years, remember, this is a novel, really a story about two Catholic buddies roaming the countryside in search of God, and he always used to say, and we found him. But nevertheless, there was something about Neil Cassady in his actual person, which was rather terrifying to Jack Kerouac. I mean, he wouldn't have been so interesting to him if he was perfect. And the fact that he could, in the novel, abandon Sal Paradise in his moment of need is pretty telling and terrifying, and shows us the darker side of the American imagination.
You note in your book, again, it's called Promised Land by my guest Jay Perini, about how the aggressively male quality of Kerouac's imagination, expressed in this road novel starring two men, has sometimes turned off female readers. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's such a male novel. I mean, when you think of it, what are women in this novel but sex objects? They don't really come through as characters very, very much on their own. I mean, a little bit. But for the most part, these are adolescent boys wanting to have sex. They want to get laid. And so that's really their adolescent mentality, which shimmers through. And there's a kind of naive boyness about this. And there's a kind of a rough male idea about sexuality here, which I think is rather immature. I mean, but, you know, they're two sides of the same coin. It's shallow, it's naive, it's sexist, it's youthful, but it's also, we see the exuberance of youth here, which really shines on every page. I mean, these hipsters of Kerouac's, you know, live at breakneck speed. They're living on the edge of society. They're living in constant opposition to their parents' generation and that mainstream culture. They're running away from the church to try and find God in nature, shall we say. And in running, and they become a kind of tribe as they move from jazz club to jazz club, as they live in their ecstatic way of being, in the perpetual movement. You know, they refuse to abide by the usual sexual mores. They search for God, as I said, and they even find him, but not in churches. You're not going to find God in churches here. They're rather like Ralph Waldo Emerson here, or Henry David Thoreau. And they find God in ponds and weeds, in fields, beautiful descriptions of the fields in this book, in the mountains as they cross over the mountains. That's where God is, in the deserts, in the prairies. And they also appreciate the vitality of city life, especially in New York and San Francisco, which are given, they become vivid characters in their own right. So these are, you know, emblematic characters, really, who, you know, become the outlaws, and they open up roads for, say, James Dean in the movies, Bob Dylan, these American rebels, who are really the kinsmen of Sal Paradise and Dean Moriarty. I mean, the Beat Generation gave way to the counterculture, as I said, of the late 60s and the 70s. And a version of that beat, you know, still pounds on the drum in the ears of young people everywhere, men and women, I think.
On the Road by Jack Kerouac is one of the books addressed in Jay Perini's book, Promised Land. Would the book, which was written a number of years ago, be any different if you wrote it today?
I do think that at every stage in my writing life, I'd have 13 different books that changed America. But I think that again and again, this book has readers keep writing to me. It's been 10 years or 11 years since I wrote Promised Land. And I hate to tell you the number of emails I've had and letters from students over the years. It's been used in courses. It's been read by reading groups. A lot of sort of reading clubs have taken my book as a kind of guidebook and have read the 13 books, and they always write to me saying, oh, I don't know why you chose this book or that book. But, you know, and the endless arguments that I've had with people, you know, I would note that I have an appendix here, 100 more books that changed America. So, you know, you could easily, I put in the Whole Earth Catalog and the Pentagon Papers, and there's Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. At one point or another, these were all books that I really wanted to write about. I wanted to write about Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. So what I tried to do in this book was find books that would represent different aspects of American society, the immigrant experience, for example, starting with Plymouth Plantation and finally going to modern immigration in the book called The Promised Land by Mary Anton. And I look at, you know, various aspects of American society, the racial aspect. I mean, I don't just do Uncle Tom's Cabin. I move on quickly to The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois. And I think that is a crucial book for us, even to this day. How often do I, in my daily life, quote The Souls of Black Folk, where he says the crucial line in American history is the racial line, the racial divide. And he, more than anybody, Du Bois, understood race in America and the problems of race and the possibilities for overcoming the racial divide.
His name is Jay Perini. He is D.E. Axon Professor of English and Creative Writing at Middlebury College. He's a poet, a novelist, a biographer. We've been talking about his book, Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. Jay, thanks so much for this book, Promised Land. Thanks so much for joining us.
Listen, I've really enjoyed our conversation, so thank you for having me on.
And that interview first aired on January 13th of this year. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.